Joe Palmer, the other boy murderer of William Kirk, was probably doomed regardless of the Berner verdict and the riot and massacre that followed. But those events made the outcome of his trial inevitable. Palmer's defense counsel basically used the same defense that Berner had, trying to place most of the blame on Berner, calling witnesses to testify that Palmer was dim-witted, that he was easily led, and they tried to argue that his confession, like Berner, had been coerced. But Palmer's problem was that he lacked any of the tells and proof of coercion that Berner was actually subjected to. The jury quickly found him guilty, although the Ohio Supreme Court decided that the jury might have reached their verdict a little too easily. During jury selection, one of the men who wound up on the jury said that he believed that Palmer was guilty and that the defense would have to prove otherwise during the trial to change his mind. The Supreme Court ruled that Palmer had been denied the basic presumption of innocence that every defendant is supposed to enjoy in the United States. And it was a valid point. Prosecutors are supposed to prove that a defendant is guilty. Defense attorneys are not supposed to have the burden of proving their client is innocent. So the verdict was overturned and a new trial was ordered. Not receiving this news of the overturned verdict until the night before his execution, Palmer became atypically emotional, shedding tears of relief. And his sister was overjoyed. She believed that this was renewed hope that he would receive life in prison rather than the death penalty. Now, this wasn't a popular opinion, but she also wasn't entirely alone. Based on all the news coverage that called the Berner verdict an outrage and that portrayed Berner and Palmer as at least equally guilty, some black Cincinnatians thought that it was unjust for these two young men to receive such disparate sentences. In its coverage of the Palmer verdict, the New York Times wrote that, quote, "The case against Berner was the strongest, and for that reason, he was tried first," unquote. Now, the case against Berner was not stronger. And he was clearly tried first because his legal dream team insisted on it. It wasn't the prosecution that tried him first. But like before the riot, news coverage followed an emotional insistence that the Berner jury was corrupt. Unfortunately for Palmer, the jury in his second trial didn't share this concern, and they found him guilty in less than 2 hours of deliberation. And he was sentenced to hang on July 15th, 1885. And this time, the verdict was upheld. Palmer was going to the gallows. But there was a question of where those gallows would be. Ohio's legislature was very active in the wake of the National Guard massacre, the courthouse riot, call it what you will. They were very active responding to criticisms of the criminal justice system in several ways. They made it easier to seat jurors, and they decreased the huge disparity between the prosecution's number of challenges to potential jurors and the defendants, and also between Palmer's sentencing hearing and his execution date. A new law moved all hangings from the county of conviction to the state penitentiary in Columbus. The rationale was twofold. Hangings had caused disturbances in the past. This was usually due to over-exuberant crowds. Second, While capital punishment was extremely popular in the 19th century, some people objected to the barbaric, lasciviously gruesome way hangings were typically conducted. Moving them inside the penitentiary made them semi-private. The proceedings would be more dignified and more humane. But because this law was passed between Palmer's sentencing and the hanging date, and the law did not specifically state whether or not it was retroactive, it was unclear whether it applied to Palmer. So the judge who had sentenced Palmer to death concluded that it was entirely up to Sheriff Beresford to decide whether Palmer would be hanged in Cincinnati or Columbus. Now, Sheriff Hawkins was one of the first political casualties of the courthouse riot. He dropped out of the race for re-election to sheriff, but the Democratic brand was so unpopular that Republican candidate Beresford won the seat of sheriff in the fall 1884 election, and he was sworn into office on January 1, 1885. If Beresford chose to hang Palmer, it would be his administration's first execution, and due to the change in the law, it would also be its only execution. Initially, Beresford seemed inclined to send Palmer to Columbus, but something changed his mind. Now, it's unclear exactly why Beresford made the decision that he did, but Horace Taft's personal letters suggest a motive. Now, Horace Taft was one of Will Taft's brothers, and he was his roommate at this time. Writing shortly after Beresford was elected, Horace said that local Republicans were, quote, very much disgusted with the sheriff whom they elected, calling him a villain in every respect. He was accused of using his office for unseemly profits. Reportedly, Beresford said, quote, I am a poor man and want to make as much out of the office as I can, unquote. This may explain why he kept the hanging in Hamilton County and why he issued roughly 300 more tickets to the execution than Sheriff Hawkins did for the last execution that he oversaw. If so, the new, inexperienced sheriff's greed had a catastrophic consequence for Joe Palmer. Palmer's cool calm fascinates the press at this time. He holds a rare degree of bravado, and he has adjusted to jail life well. Mentally, part of this is attributed to his recent conversion to Catholicism and his unwavering belief that he is about to ascend a golden staircase to heaven. A reporter describes his handsome, light-skinned face and the dimples that give him a boyish charm. Laying on his cot with his shirt unbuttoned and open, the reporter calls his muscular chest and neck magnificent. He has gained both weight and muscle in jail, and racial taboos and his refusal to engage reporters are probably the only things preventing Joseph Palmer from being a jailhouse heartthrob like Crazy Joe Payton had been. But his thick, muscular neck is about to change how he dies. People who had one of the roughly 400 total tickets that had been issued by the sheriff started arriving to get good viewing spots in the jail courtyard at 7 a.m. on the morning of Palmer's execution. Now, shortly after this, deputies started hanging the large black drapes along the perimeter fence that would deny the spectators gathering in the streets a view of the hanging. Inside the jail, Palmer met with his priest, several friends, and he ate a last meal of chicken, pork tenderloin, potatoes, a pastry, ice cream, and coffee. It was tradition to provide the condemned with a new, tailored suit for both the hanging and the burial. And someone asked him if it was more appropriate to button the jacket he wore over a vest. Palmer smiled at the odd futility of the question. He said he guessed so, and he buttoned the jacket while he was being handcuffed. He maintained his machismo to the end, walking to the gallows with what was described as a light swagger. I asked him if he had any final words. Palmer just shook his head no. Since police jobs were still doled out on the political spoil system, some of Republican Sheriff Beresford's deputies had replaced Democratic sheriff deputies, and they were inexperienced in conducting a hanging. They cinched the noose incorrectly, tightening it slightly in front of Palmer's right ear rather than the back of the neck. And with the rope still trailing down his back, deputies accidentally wrapped the thick leather belt that went around the condemned man's midsection into it. They only caught that major error when people in the crowd started yelling, "Take out the rope!" And although Palmer had remained steely until now, he had a hood over his face at this point, and he didn't know what they were yelling about, and the shouting from the crowd and the incompetent fumbling of the deputies caused him to grow really wobbly on his feet. And finally, they got everything straightened out, and word was given for the sheriff to pull the lever. And the trapdoor swung open from under Palmer's feet. Now, Palmer should have fallen about 4 feet from the base of the platform, dying instantly from a broken neck. But the rope was incompetently short, and his body only dropped about 18 inches. And due to the thick muscularity of his neck, and the incorrect position of the noose, and the inadequate drop, his neck was not broken. Spectators watched his head and body jerk in horrific convulsions as he agonizingly strangled to death. He exhibited a pulse for 18 minutes, and his heart didn't stop until 26 minutes after the drop. The last execution conducted in Hamilton County, Ohio, was terribly botched. It was agonizing, and it was brutal. Palmer's body was cut down and buried in consecrated ground in St. Joseph's Cemetery. Alive, Palmer was considered a vicious, worthless, cold-blooded murderer. But he immediately started to develop an odd legacy in death. He began earning a role in one of the many aspects of disinformation and misinformation that rewrote the history of everything surrounding the National Guard massacre. Once Palmer was dead, there was no longer any reason to write about his sociopathic demeanor. But the press, who had helped feed Cincinnati a narrative that inflamed it into a lynch mob, seemed to want to continue to attack Berner to maybe in part abdicate their own responsibility. In reality, Berner and Palmer displayed very different dispositions. Neither one of them were innocent, but Palmer consistently outwardly displayed psychopathic tendencies, whereas Berner frequently broke into crying fits and babbling. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that he was remorseful, but he at least appeared to be remorseful, and especially compared to Palmer, who had said shortly after his confession, when asked about his guilt and his remorse, Palmer said, quote, "I could eat my dinner with Kirk's body on my lap," unquote. Which doesn't show much remorse. Cincinnati Inquirer didn't give Palmer's version of events any credence during his trial. But after his death, the paper treated his defense narrative as if it was absolute gospel fact, writing that Berner had been cool and self-possessed when he threatened to kill Palmer if he didn't help. The paper that had written the incendiary College of Murder article immediately before the riot now wrote that, quote, Berner, the more intelligent of the two, not only laid the plan, but was foremost in its execution, unquote. And the St. Louis Post-Dispatch went the extra mile, inventing a false biography for Berner as, quote, a vicious lad, hard to manage, and with bad habits, unquote. It blamed the bloodshed of March 84 on the, quote, farcical trial of William Berner. While perpetuating the myth of a corrupt trial, the paper suggested that the only reason Palmer was hanged and Berner was not was because Palmer, quote, had no one to befriend him as he was only a poor Negro, unquote. Apologies for the language, but that was actually respectful terminology in 1885. They were trying to show sympathy for Palmer, or at least indignity towards racial injustice. And over the decades, the racial angle of the story sometimes developed a life of its own. In October 1932, 72-year-old Sam Edwards died. He was a recluse and was living in a small shack near the bank of the Big Miami River, roughly 16 miles northeast of Cincinnati. He'd been a farmer and a carpenter. He never got married. He lived in seclusion. And he was said to have lived that way because he was forever shunned by his former friends and the community around him for being on the Berner jury. He was effectively sentenced to a lifetime role of solitude for answering a call to jury duty in March 1884. His death sparked a lot of retrospective articles about the courthouse riot, each one of them more inaccurate than the next. The Cincinnati Inquirer recalled how National Guard troops were forced to kill and wound many men because, quote, snipers from the crowd picked off militiamen, unquote. The paper went on to further completely rewrite the facts, writing that, quote, a Negro, Joseph Palmer, had been sentenced to hang for beating his employer to death. Then Edwards and his co-jurors convicted William Berner, a white man, only of manslaughter in the same killing. By flipping the order of the trials from what actually happened, and by eliminating the actual differences in culpability that were shown at those trials, Edward and his fellow jurors were posthumously accused of reaching their verdict through pure, unadulterated racism. Other papers followed suit. Obituaries for Sam Edwards ran across the U.S., and none of them were kind. Generally, the stories reiterated how a combination of corruption and racism led Berner to a light sentence and Palmer to hang. By 1932, it was accepted fact that the Berner jury was corrupt, and now they were also racist. And the National Guard were heroes who took casualties battling snipers in the streets. I'm Mike Morgan, a writer, attorney, historian, and far too white trash to be in the Epstein files. But Amy, if there happens to be 50 pages missing from the Bramble Trailer Park dossier on felony-level drunk and disorderly conduct in the 1990s, I could be the reason.
I am so glad to hear that. And I'm Amy Morgan. I'm also an attorney. I enjoy history, but I'm actually more of a true crime and politics junkie. And I'm helping tell this story because it's fascinating and it involves all of those things.
And this is Truth Deferred, Season 1, The National Guard Massacre. A true story about biased media, corruption, murder, a slaughter of unarmed civilians by National Guard troops, and the cover-up that followed. A cover-up which hid the truth so well that this is the first time it's being told.
Joe Palmer was the last person to ever be hanged in Cincinnati, but the first person to die in retribution for the riots takes us back to episode 1, when we told you the story of William and Sophia McHugh. William McHugh was an emotional guy. He wore his heart on his sleeve. He loved too hard, and he drank too much. That didn't excuse murdering his wife, but there was nothing cold-blooded about William McHugh. Legally, he'd committed premeditated murder, but on a purely human level, it was a crime of passion, an emotional impulse that he seemed to genuinely be remorseful for every day for the rest of his life. To reporters and other inmates, he spoke lovingly of Sophia, kept a large, framed picture of her on the wall of his cell, and he had a lot of sympathy from his working-class peers and numerous friends. And he was a model prisoner. His cell was cozy and well-maintained. His shirts were always immaculately cleaned and his shoes freshly polished. He spent his mornings voraciously reading the newspapers, visited with his elderly mother every day, and sold poetry that he wrote to raise money for her.
Mary McHugh, his grief-stricken mom, was an even greater recipient of public sympathy than William was. She was widowed at an early age, and she raised three children as a house servant in abject poverty. Now, older and no longer healthy enough to do manual labor, she was completely destitute and periodically homeless, and she spent her days weeping inconsolably at the fear of losing her son.
He was very well liked among both guards and prisoners, and an Enquirer reporter wrote that, quote, "One cannot converse with him without feeling the utmost sympathy for the doomed man," unquote. His lawyers liked him, too. They worked for free, they worked hard, and even though they lost all of them, they successfully got him three trials, three chances at an acquittal by making smart, aggressive arguments. And when the last appeal failed, they turned their attention to Governor Hoadley, taking Mary McHugh to Columbus to plead for her son's life, and sending the governor petition signed by 1,219 people asking for McHugh's life to be spared.
Even members of the grand jury that indicted him and the jurors that convicted him wanted his sentence commuted. If they'd had the option, his juries would have probably given him life in prison. But as we have discussed previously, hanging was mandatory for first-degree murder convictions. Only the governor could help. And in the absence of discretion in sentencing like we have today, the governor often did. Before the riot, Hoadley had commuted sentences for far less sympathetic characters than McHugh. But after the riot?
McHugh summed it up quite eloquently when he said that his chances of commutation were, quote, "extremely dubious now," unquote. It would have been political suicide for Hoadley to stop the first scheduled hanging after the riot, and on April 30th, 1884, Hoadley announced that he was not going to intervene. McHugh's only hope lay in an afterlife.
And he wasn't certain about post-death clemency either. Father Brady, the jail priest, was his spiritual advisor. And I have to admit to you, Amy, that I sort of respect his complete lack of bedside manner with condemned prisoners. He explained to a reporter, gruffly, quote, "Our church does not favor that nonsense which appears in so many murderers' remarks as they approach the gallows, to the effect that their sins are forgiven, and that they are going straight to heaven, and all that sort of trash," unquote. He said that the best you could do was repent, pray, and hope for the best. Although, in McHugh's case, this hard-boiled priest said that he believed that McHugh's remorse and repentance was genuine, and he gave him the best shot at the pearly gates that any convicted killer was going to get from Father Brady.
For his part, McHugh said he didn't know if there was a heaven or a hell or not, but he vowed to meet his fate like a man. And he did, although his final meeting with his wailing and overwrought mother was so torturous that I don't think anyone could have witnessed it without shedding some tears.
On the evening before his execution, McHugh gathered the prisoners in the jail around for a final farewell. He blamed his mistakes on alcohol, and he told the men to live sober, honest lives when they got out. Then he bid them all goodbye, and he shook hands as several of the convicts cried. To reporters, he implored them not to write anything negative about Sophia.
In the morning, his lawyers came to wish him goodbye with tears streaming down their cheeks. Police Lieutenant Devine came to his cell to wish him well. He asked him how he was holding up, and McHugh told him, quote, "I have a terrible ordeal to pass through, Captain, but I am ready." He then got dressed in the new suit that was delivered, as was the custom. He shouted out his cell window to the foreman of the carriage factory across the street, who was a friend, and they waved goodbye to each other. Sheriff Hawkins came in, read the death warrant. Then Father Brady started walking with him on the route to the gallows in the courtyard behind the jail, with prisoners wishing him well on the way.
I learned something about Catholicism from Father Brady, Amy. He did not read McHugh Extreme Unction, what's typically called last rites, because he said it was inappropriate in executions.
Why? Was it because he was a murderer?
Nope. That didn't have anything to do with it. He explained that Extreme Unction is for the dying, and it wasn't appropriate in executions because McHugh was a perfectly healthy young man, and he would be right up to the second that his neck snapped.
Well, here's a little gallows etiquette right back at ya. Ohio law placed strict limitations on who could witness an execution. It was limited to a clergyman, three people designated by the prisoner, and six witnesses chosen by the sheriff. The only other people who could be present were the sheriff and his deputies.
So how did they invite and probably sell tickets to hundreds of people?
Well, when McHugh got to the scaffold, Sheriff Hawkins had the roughly 250 people packing the jail yards raise their right hands so that he could swear everyone in as necessary temporary deputy sheriffs so that it was legal for them to be there.
That is greasy. And it helps explain why they changed the protocols before Joe Palmer was the last man to be hanged in Cincinnati. So does the incompetence of the hanging. When he was a Cincinnati Inquirer reporter, Sheriff Hawkins had witnessed six hangings, but this was the first one that he conducted. And like his successor in office, he botched it. McHugh fell 7 feet, which was definitely an adequate drop. But the noose was too loose, and it was improperly placed. So the autopsy showed that his neck was not broken. He strangled to death.
Although he was broke, he was laid to rest in a satin-lined rosewood casket with silver hardware and a silver cross on top. The expensive casket was donated by Undertaker Mulvihill, who had been friends with McHugh. He had a lot of friends. So many that Father Brady started the funeral services a half hour early because St. Xavier Cathedral was already packed to capacity.
Father Brady eulogized McHugh by saying, quote, "I do not blame him so much, for his crime was a frailty superinduced by the demon drink." And he asked the crowd to pray for McHugh so that his sins might be forgiven. Large funeral procession then wound its way to St. Joseph's Cemetery on the west side, where his body remains in an unmarked grave not far from Joe Palmer's.
Many people today would say that William McHugh got exactly what he deserved. Others would say that his highly premeditated public strangulation isn't how a civilized society should respond to crime. But in 1884, to a city full of people who had been told by their newspapers that murder was going to become as rampant as disorderly conduct if they didn't start hanging more killers, McHugh had to die for William Berner and T.C. Campbell's sins. Ultimately, this would be a short-lived frenzy of executions before things returned to essentially how they'd been before March 1884. But for William McHugh, the luck of the Irish turned out to be extremely unlucky timing.
McHugh was the first to hang after the courthouse riot, but he wasn't the first accused murderer to leave the jail dead. That honor belonged to Allen Ingalls. Both Ingalls and Johnson, the duo that murdered the Taylor family to sell their bodies, lost their composure in jail. Ingalls held up better than Johnson did, but he grew depressed and despondent. Like McHugh, he saw the writing on the wall. No court-appointed lawyer was going to save him in the current judicial climate. He was doomed. The Evening Post even wrote that his upcoming trial would be, quote, merely regarded as pro forma, unquote. He was going to lose his trial, and he was going to die for his crime. His bravado started to sink away, and he spent fitful nights of insomnia overwrought with absolute terror. He seems to have had one fear above all else. And do you know what that fear was, Amy?
I mean, mine would be getting hanged.
Well, he wasn't in favor of that part, but something seemed to actually bother him more than being hanged.
Would it be spending eternity in a lake of fire?
Nope.
Spiders?
No, that's your biggest fear. Allen Ingalls' most gnawing fear, the one that kept him up with insomnia every night, was the fear that after he was dead, a resurrectionist would steal his body and he'd wind up being an undignified dissection subject for medical students.
You're telling me that the resurrectionist who didn't care whose grave he robbed and who murdered people to sell their bodies to a medical school actually lived in fear of having his body stolen?
Yeah, it's ironic, right? Some of the more ethical resurrectionists in town genuinely believed, and not without cause, that what they did was important for the future of science and medicine. And two of the most locally famous ones, including a guy who was called Old Cunny, sold their own bodies to medical schools in advance. And Old Cunny's skeleton was even displayed in one of the medical schools with a shovel in its hand. Dark humor. But, you know, no pun intended, there was not a single decent bone in Allen Ingalls' body. He was a purely evil psychopath. About a month before his trial, he got another inmate to write a letter to his wife. And another inmate write it because he was illiterate. Although he was roughly a month from trial, and the law required a minimum of 100 days between sentencing and execution, his letter said that it might be his last one. He told his wife that he hoped to see her in heaven, where they could be eternally happy together, although she should feel free to remarry, and he sent his love to their children. But the most important thing he said was, quote, if anything should happen to me, please don't fail to take me home.
It's nice that he gave her permission to remarry. Otherwise, I'm sure she would have spent her life pining away, thinking what a wonderful husband he was. But it was, in fact, his last letter. Sometime between lights out and 4 a.m., Ingalls ripped a piece of bedsheet, tied one end to an iron bar on the window, and made a slipknot with the other end. Based on the scene, he stood on his cot below the window, put the noose around his neck, and kicked the cot out from under his feet. Although he was a very short man, his toes still reached the floor, even with his knees bent, and the coroner thought it probably took him over 20 minutes to die. It was not an easy death.
But he didn't do it to die easier. He seems to have been mostly motivated to commit suicide because he thought that it would result in more control over what happened to his body. In addition to the letter to his wife, he had the same inmate write a note saying, quote, "Please send my body, just as it is, to my wife. She will pay all expenses." And he tucked it into the brim of his hat so that it would be found in his cell when they found his body.
He didn't get much dignity in death. News of his suicide spread quickly, and after his body was taken to Habig's funeral home, a huge crowd gathered outside. Eventually, Habig's thought they needed to let people see the body in an organized way to keep control. So they let an estimated 5,000 people file past his corpse. He was even subjected to a limited amount of dissection when the coroner let a doctor bring in medical school students to remove his trachea and examine the cause of death.
Elizabeth Ingalls, his wife, learned about his death from an Inquirer reporter who found her washing clothes for one of the families she worked for. She broke into tears, and she regained her composure and asked the reporter. She explained she couldn't take off work that day. She asked the reporter to tell the funeral home that she would go to Cincinnati to make arrangements the next day. And when she came to town, she had to see her husband's remains by standing in line with hundreds of gawkers, a lot of whom just insulted him and made jokes as they passed. She was reportedly offered $100 to sell the body to a medical school, just for the novelty and the justice of it. She declined that offer. She didn't have the money for a private burial, but she scraped it together somehow, and she had Ingalls buried in United Colored American Cemetery. It's called United American Cemetery today, and it's the oldest all-black cemetery in Cincinnati. And ironically, it was a place that Ingalls probably stole a lot of bodies from. Only Elizabeth and one of her sons attended the funeral. The other two kids refused to come. His grave was unmarked, and he presumably remains buried there to this day, undisturbed.
Even though Alan Ingalls was suicidal, Ben Johnson's mental health was probably worse by comparison. His cell was one of several that was attacked with a battering ram by the lynch mob on Friday night of the riot. The following day, even though the battle was in a lull, Johnson remained mostly in bed, visibly shaking and barely able to speak. In the days afterward, as other prisoners regained their composure, Johnson didn't. Other prisoners described him as, quote, "a trembling, whining cur," unquote. Even Ingalls refused to associate with him. Immediately following Ingalls' suicide, he grew even more despondent, remaining crouched up in bed, nonverbal.
As the only person left to take the blame for the Avondale murders, the outcome of Johnson's trial was a foregone conclusion. Prosecutor Pugh established that he was a knowing, voluntary participant in the murder of the Taylor family at every stage, and that he had personally strangled Beverly Taylor to death after Ingalls beat him in the head with a club. His court-appointed defense attorney did a good job with what he had to work with, but he didn't have much to work with. It tried to evoke sympathy for Johnson's childhood and slavery, which was bad, but it also was not a defense. The jury only deliberated for an hour before returning a guilty verdict. The trial was short. From the start of jury selection to Judge Maxwell sentencing him to hang on September 12, 1884, the whole thing took under 2 weeks. This reflected a significant change in the local administration of justice. Trials had become much shorter, deliberation times were short, and juries convicted almost everybody of everything. There were more arrests, more aggressive prosecutions, and judges started handing out harsh sentences for even minor crimes. By the time Johnson was sentenced, there were 6 men in jail waiting on their execution date.
At sentencing, Judge Maxwell told Johnson to get right with God, and that's what he set his mind to. Being sentenced to die turned out to be great for his mental health. By throwing himself into religion and getting baptized as a Methodist, he became jovial and started socializing with other prisoners again, actually seeming very lighthearted. He didn't have any of William McHugh's doubts. He had full faith that he was going to go to heaven, and he said, quote, "I don't think I got a fair shake down here, but I will up there."
Good luck on that. But he would get agitated anytime someone came to the jail to ask him questions about dead or missing loved ones. After the facts of the Avondale murders became known, Margaret Hopkins was one of those people. She had attached new meaning to Alan Ingalls being the last person to have been seen with her husband, Michael Hopkins, before he vanished without a trace off the face of the earth several years earlier. Ingalls also became a suspect in a Glendale murder, and an Avondale town drunk came forward with an absolute hair-raising story about how he barely escaped Ingalls and Johnson one night. Now, Johnson denied having any involvement in any other murders, and maybe he wasn't involved in any other murders. But there was mounting speculation and at least circumstantial evidence that Alan Ingalls had been a serial killer for years.
On the morning of his hanging, Johnson dressed in a new suit, was given a glass of brandy for his nerves, and was marched off to the scaffold. He addressed the crowd with his final words, saying that he knew he was about to go to heaven and claiming that he was innocent of the murders. The hanging was performed properly, and Johnson died instantly from a broken neck.
It was a bad time to be a criminal in Cincinnati, but no National Guard soldier or commander was ever held to any account for the dozens of lives taken and the thousands that were changed forever. And all of the lessons that could have been and should have been learned about how to avoid unnecessary casualties, those lessons were never even considered. In fact, guardsmen were used frequently in the late 19th and early 20th century to help suppress labor strikes in particular. And they often did so with completely unnecessary fatalities. So if Cincinnati's National Guard massacre had any impact on broader national policy, it was arguably to help normalize mass casualties.
Changes came to the National Guard slowly. Minor federal improvements were made in 1887, but Guard regiments still had to rely heavily on private funding, and they often seemed to work for their wealthy, capitalist donors to help quash the labor movement. When William McKinley became governor of Ohio, he increased funding to the National Guard 70%, and he took a lot of direct interest in how guardsmen were trained and utilized. And when he became president, the Spanish-American War became a catalyst for completely revamping the National Guard system. McKinley was assassinated before the changes were implemented. But in 1903, after William Howard Taft had been appointed Secretary of War, the Uniform Militia Act of 1792 was finally repealed, after 111 years of being mostly ignored. And it was replaced with new legislation that created clear federal training standards and properly armed and funded troops. This also corresponded to states dramatically improving their own funding. The changes were essentially everything that the United States National Guard Association wanted to do when it met in Cincinnati in 1884. With additional changes in 1908 and in 1916, right before World War I, the ragtag, unfunded state militia system transformed into the modern National Guard.
That means a much more professional military force than they were before. But in some ways, the National Guard has stayed basically the same. The U.S. constitutional framework is exactly the same. And each state still controls its National Guard. They are a state's voluntary army. And there are still ways that the states can use National Guard troops that the federal government cannot. And all of this is taking us back to one of the questions we started this season with. Could the 1884 Cincinnati National Guard massacre happen again in another American city in the weeks or months or years ahead? And the answer to that is and remains maybe.
In Reconstruction, following the Civil War, the federal government used army troops to enforce new civil rights laws. This was often necessary to protect the rights of black citizens to vote, for example, but Southerners grew increasingly angry at having Northern federal soldiers in their streets performing police functions. The U.S. presidential election in 1876 was absolute chaos. Vote counts were disputed in multiple states, and it came down to a stalemate and a constitutional crisis that looked like it might re-spark the Civil War. Ultimately, Democrats and Republicans met in smoke-filled back rooms to cut an infamous deal. Although Democrat Samuel Tilden won the popular vote, and he may have won the Electoral College too, Democrats essentially gave the election to Republican Rutherford B. Hayes in 1877. In return, the Republicans, who had previously championed the end of slavery and the 19th century civil rights movement, agreed to sell out Southern black citizens in exchange for power. Hayes pulled all Northern federal troops out of the South, handed it over to white supremacists, and ended Reconstruction. Part of the compromise was the passage of the Posse Comitatus Act in 1878.
So the origins of the Posse Comitatus Act are very dubious. But in the generations that followed, it has been a source of important protections for all American citizens. What Posse Comitatus says is confusing as hell, but the idea is pretty straightforward. The U.S. military cannot be used for law enforcement against U.S. citizens unless narrowly defined exceptions apply. Now, this means that U.S. military troops cannot be used to pursue suspects, arrest people, apprehend people, conduct evidence searches or collect evidence, seize people's property, conduct security patrols, traffic control, perform crowd control or riot control, or interrogate people.
Posse Comitatus prevents branches of the federal military from being used as cops or deployed against American citizens. But when does it apply to the National Guard?
If Congress calls up the National Guard, they're federalizing those state troops. And when they're federalized, Posse Comitatus applies to the National Guard in the exact same way that it applies to U.S. Army, Marines, or Navy soldiers. In that instance, Marines and Guardsmen, same thing. But if National Guard troops are called up by a governor, Posse Comitatus does not apply. And National Guard troops can be used to supplement police actions, to do all of those things that I just listed that they cannot do when they're federalized. And they can definitely be used for crowd control and riots.
So there are very different rules for what the National Guard can be ordered to do in American cities based on whether their mission is local or federal, based on who calls them into service. Posse Comitatus does not apply when state officials call them into service. State governors can call up the National Guard to assist in emergencies, including national disasters or riots.
And Congress can, quoting the Constitution, call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, unquote. Now, this is typically interpreted to mean calling up guardsmen for war service to send them off to foreign wars. When guardsmen are called into duty by Congress, the president is commander-in-chief of the National Guard forces, and the troops work for the federal government. A posse comitatus prevents them from being used as police or as riot control in those circumstances, unless one of the few narrow exceptions in the law applies. Now, the most important of those exceptions is if it is necessary to use them to prevent an insurrection.
Which is why you may have heard people on the news in 2025 and 2026 discussing the Insurrection Act. And many people speculate that is why Donald Trump and members of his administration have frequently referred to protesters as insurrectionists. All of this means that there are two ways that the modern National Guard troops can be pitted against unarmed citizens today. To really boil it down, the first way is if a governor calls something a riot. The second is if Congress calls it an insurrection.
And it's important to emphasize the word Congress. Even though it happened in 2025 and might happen again, the president is not absolutely, unequivocally, the president is not constitutionally authorized to use National Guard troops without congressional authorization. Period. And if you, and more importantly than you, no offense, if the courts follow the letter and intent of the Insurrection Act, you can only use National Guard troops with important prerequisites. If, for example, you know, there is another Fort Sumter, the federal government can use National Guard troops however it wants to. But legally, you cannot order them to shoot protesters just because you call them insurrectionists.
And this isn't 1884. As we've discussed, National Guard troops are still volunteers, but training and funding has gotten a lot better in the last 140 years. Although there are still some worrying problems with sovereign immunity, the laws that give a wide range of law enforcement officers protection when they use deadly force, legal accountability has gotten a lot better since the era of our story. And although governors can, and still do, use National Guard troops for crowd control, in addition to the troops being better trained, the chain of command being clearer, it's not politically popular for governors to let soldiers kill unarmed protesters, even if they are actually rioting and looting. Even in 1884, Governor George Hoadley wound up paying a political price for the deaths in Cincinnati.
Guardsmen are much better trained, but they're still volunteers. And they're still soldiers. They're not cops. And to be clear here, nothing in the course of this podcast is meant to be disrespectful to the people who serve in the National Guard. They do amazing public service, particularly after national disasters. They played a huge role during COVID. They serve heroically in wars, and they are extremely, embarrassingly underpaid for the sacrifices they make and the service they provide. But one of the biggest points of this story that we have told, at its core, is that it is always inherently dangerous to use military troops against civil unrest. Even in Cincinnati in March 1884, there were some terrible decisions and maybe a few malicious people, but I do not believe that the vast majority of National Guardsmen who shot people in the street were bad men. They did some terrible things, but they did them because they were ordered to do them.
One of the biggest, scariest parallels between then and now may be the whitewash that came after the massacre, and also the way that your chosen source of news impacted your reality. Depending on where you got your news back in 1884, and based on official reports of government officials, all of the bloodshed was caused by T.C. Campbell and a corrupt jury, and the National Guard were heroes because they were battling an armed, dangerously violent mob of immigrants who all got what they deserved.
It sounds a lot like the things we've heard in the news in 2025 and 2026. School teachers and nurses have been among the people shot in the streets by federal agents and who have then called domestic terrorists by government officials. And depending on where you choose to get your news, you may not question that assessment. We are going to try to stay out of politics, but we do need to get back to the politics of 1884 and the years immediately after that.
There were no criminal consequences for the politicians that, at a minimum, deserved some scrutiny after the riot, including Governor Hoadley, Sheriff Hawkins, Mayor Stevens, and Coroner Muscroft. But there were political consequences for them. Sort of. At least in the short term. It became a bad time to be a Democrat in Cincinnati.
Coroner Muscroft's verdict on the massacre victims was an attempt to absolve every Democratic politician involved. And it was an act of his party loyalty. But even though his findings had a way of largely becoming accepted history, in real time, most people knew that it was an astounding pile of lies, nonsense, and cover-up. And that helped ensure that Muscroft was not reelected.
In the short term, Sheriff Hawkins also paid a price. While most people started referring to the events of March 28th through the 30th as the courthouse riot, the Commercial Gazette insisted on referring to it as the sheriff's riot. Hawkins claimed that he dropped out of the race for re-election because he wanted to retire from politics. But it seemed clear that he was forced out behind the scenes as a political liability. Sheriff Beresford, the clearly corrupt Republican who botched Joe Palmer's hanging, succeeded him.
He also lost his position as commander of the Veterans Guard, which was one of the remaining militia groups that was unaffiliated with the National Guard. Although he lost that post for different reasons than you might expect. It was not due to his incompetence or all of the unnecessary death. Some of his men supported him fervently, but others hated him for stopping a mass lynching, which they still thought should have been the right outcome. They were still pro-lynching. So that's why they kicked him out of the Veterans Guard. But he was embraced by the National Guard's 1st Regiment. They made him an officer, and he eventually rose to become adjutant general, the statewide commander of the Ohio National Guard. And in that position, he oversaw the completion of the statue honoring the martyred Captain John J. Desmond, and he was highly, and highly ironically, praised for his impressive ability to lead a parade commemorating the slaughter that he oversaw in 1884.
But the Democratic Cincinnati Inquirer, where Hawkins once worked as a reporter, didn't even let the dust settle before it started reforming Morton Hawkins' reputation. In the wake of the courthouse riot, during the temporary spate of death sentences issued in Hamilton County, Hawkins presided over an unprecedented number of hangings, which boosted his popularity, and he left office in what arguably should have been disgrace. The Inquirer recalled his tenure by writing that he, quote, went through the trying ordeal of the riots and came out of that period with credit to himself, unquote. Concluding that Hawkins was undoubtedly one of the best sheriffs Hamilton County ever had.
We have only speculated about why Mayor Stevens was missing in action on Friday and Saturday night, because that's all we can do. Even if he were too sick to get out of bed when he was desperately needed to fulfill his role as the person who was supposed to be in charge during a riot, and supposed to be not just as a matter of leadership, but specifically as a requirement of state statute, there has never been an explanation either for how he was so miraculously recovered by Sunday, or why there is no record or reference to him even attempting to do his job until everything was effectively over. All we do know is that when his city needed him, he was holed up and silent. And when he finally showed up for work on Sunday, he looked like a friggin' buffoon. He delegated his decision-making to the city's wealthy businessmen, including many of the same people who called the music hall meeting that made a lot of what followed it inevitable. There were no repercussions for any of those wealthy people who gave pro-lynching speeches, or for Henry Erner, who served as a virtually limitless font of bad advice. But Stevens didn't fare as well politically. Prior to the riots, he had been a very popular mayor, and with good reason. He had served 5 terms on city council as a Democrat in a Republican ward. He was a smart, moderate leader that people from both parties liked, and he had really good management skills under normal circumstances. He might have just been really terrible in a crisis. But whatever the reasons were, Cincinnatians were not ultimately impressed with Mayor Stevens. And he was also not reelected. Although in his remaining time in office, he helped feed a false narrative of history by issuing multiple proclamations thanking and vehemently praising the National Guard for saving the city of Cincinnati.
Electorally, the next few elections were a bloodbath for Democrats in general. They lost virtually every meaningful political office. That was one of the long-lasting impacts of the riot. The Taft family's power rose, but they looked beyond local politics almost immediately, while simultaneously neutering T.C. Campbell as a Republican Party mover and shaker. At this time, there was a saloon owner and one-term city councilman named George Cox who learned that he was better behind the scenes than as a politician. As Republicans swept power, Cox began his rise to political party boss of the local Republican Party, eventually becoming one of the most powerful and corrupt political party bosses in the United States. He led the city into being branded by McClure's magazine as the worst run city in the nation, eventually giving rise to a third-party movement that became the longest-running, most successful political third party in American history until it imploded recently. But all of that's a different story.
And the Cincinnati police also changed in a kind of curious way. Kind of curious due in part to the adoption of the false history and to the popular wave of unforgiving law and order. During that last weekend in March, the only real heroes were some doctors, ordinary people who helped the wounded, and members of the Cincinnati Police Department. The cop that walked up to a man, probably intoxicated man, with a huge handgun and disarmed him, prevented National Guardsmen from shooting wildly into a crowd. And that same scenario basically played out twice. Other officers helped bring restraint, and they risked their own lives to keep people out of the line of fire. Cincinnati policemen, without question, saved lives that weekend. And they didn't do it with violence. They did it with restraint. They did it by de-escalating situations. And doing it in a way that I gotta admit, and Amy, you know, I'm not a guy that typically fawns over cops, but they did it in a way that I have to call pretty badass. These guys, Cincinnati police officers that were on the scene and worked that weekend, those were truly heroes. But as it turned out, the political takeaway was not how amazing they were for their restraint. The political takeaway became that the police needed to be more strict on vice crimes. They needed to beat more people up. They needed to adopt a more militant posture against every form of crime, and they needed to be better armed. And so the Cincinnati Police Department, who should have been commended for being calm and bringing restraint, instead was more militarized.
The political ramifications weren't just local. Governor George Hoadley found himself facing a veritable opponent in Republican Joseph Foraker in a race that was influenced by the courthouse riot, but in a weird way. Foraker and T.C. Campbell were friends, seemingly pretty close friends, and definitely close political allies. Foraker defended Campbell in his first criminal bribery trial, but he coldly abandoned him when he started feeling like there was a viable gubernatorial candidate, and Campbell became an increasing liability. Hoadley could have tried to link Foraker to Campbell, but that would have required bringing attention to his own incompetence. Also, both men were not only Cincinnati attorneys, they used to be neighbors. So while there is no record of a formal agreement, there is pretty strong circumstantial evidence that, either explicitly or implicitly, neither one of them brought up the courthouse riot, even though it had been international news and one of the defining moments of Hoadley's term as governor. They had a series of public debates that very loosely skirted around the issue by referencing support for the National Guard. But Foraker never attacked Hoadley for his inept leadership in March 1884, and Hoadley never brought up Foraker's relationship with the notorious T.C. Campbell.
And the sense of honor among thieves here in this upper echelon of politics was very apparent after Foraker beat Hoadley and was elected governor. Foraker may not have brought up the courthouse riot, and modern issue polling hadn't been invented yet, but there are clear signs that voters had the deaths in Cincinnati and Hoadley's continuing unconditional support of the National Guard on their minds when they went to the polls and elected Joseph Foraker the next governor of Ohio, which is when the magnanimous relationship between these two affluent Cincinnati lawyers went from gentlemanly to really just plain gross.
Foraker was sworn into office on January 11, 1886. At the inauguration, Hoadley introduced him to the crowd, expressing his seemingly heartfelt congratulations and warm wishes for success and a long, happy life, while acknowledging that it was the end to a, quote, heated political contest.
And in a way, that's actually kind of beautiful, looking back from this moment in modern American politics. But what makes my stomach turn is what came next. The Saturday after the inauguration, Foraker attended a banquet in Cincinnati called to honor George Hoadley. And the former governor spoke at this banquet, spoke about his time in office, including the hard times of being governor, which he said included clemency request, where he had to tell a grieving mother that her son would have to die. He didn't mention him by name, but the remark seemed to be a clear reference to William McHugh's devastated and hysterical mother. And then General Michael Ryan, the man who had been Hoadley's liaison to the National Guard, took the podium, and Michael Ryan became the hit speaker of the evening. He was introduced as, quote, a great military man, unquote, and everybody in attendance seemed to be in on the joke, especially Michael Ryan, who had made every decision that he was called upon to make during the courthouse riot objectively wrong. His speech was self-deprecating, but it was self-deprecating in a light, comical way that, according to the Cincinnati Inquirer, quote, created profound merriment, unquote. The audience, which included ex-Mayor Stevens, ex-Sheriff Hawkins, Time Star owner and Will Taft's brother, Charles P. Taft, all seemed to have been amused at how Ryan made his incompetence that led to the slaughter of dozens of innocent people into a really funny joke.
Then Governor Foraker rose. Showing his prowess as an off-the-cuff public speaker, Foraker began lightheartedly roasting General Michael Ryan, setting up his story in a light, breezy way that made it clear that this was all in good fun. He told the powerful, affluent audience that there was a story going around that, quote, during the riot, while the fighting was in progress, the governor wanted to communicate with Sheriff Hawkins and telegraphed this member of the staff to go and see the sheriff and procure from him a report and send it to the governor at Columbus. The answer came back from this valiant military man, unquote. I'm stopping to explain it at this point of the comments. The audience rippled with laughter. And then going on, quote, that Colonel Hawkins is at the courthouse and I cannot get to him without great personal danger, unquote. Which resulted in hilarious laughter from the audience.
And I don't mean to be a buzzkill to all this merriment, but this, with the laughter of the audience in mind, this might be a good time to remind people listening of the hundreds and hundreds of families who were either grieving loved ones or adjusting to life with a breadwinner who was missing a limb or an eye or crippled with what we would recognize today as PTSD, or for that matter, the young, good-hearted National Guardsmen who were living with the nightmares and the guilt of the uncertainty around killing innocent people in the street. It might be a good time to remind people of the mother in Over the Rhine who had to live the rest of her life knowing that her decision to relent and let her 14-year-old son go watch a fire resulted in his death. but to the rich and powerful men at the banquet, some of whom set the wheels in motion, some of whom acted like abject cowards, some of whom displayed nothing but terrible and inept leadership, some of whom acted with sociopathic bloodlust, and some of whom caused people to die through gross, inept incompetence. To those guys, it was all water under the bridge. It was something that we could all have a good laugh about. And now that it was 1886, it's just the past. And if the working class couldn't take a joke, then fuck 'em.
Joseph Foraker was an adept politician. He was governor, then an Ohio senator, and although he never rose any higher, he was someone who had the presidency within his realistic sights.
Honestly, far more unlikely to me than either T.C. Campbell or Joseph Foraker, William Howard Taft was the man who rose to the White House. And Foraker did his part to help put him on the road there. Now, Foraker went from persona non grata with the Tafts to earning their slight respect by stabbing T.C. Campbell in the back. But when he wanted to do more to ingratiate himself with this powerful family, he appointed the still really pretty young Will Taft to a superior court judgeship. Then he recommended him to the Supreme Court, which he was completely unqualified for at the time, but which indirectly led him to being appointed to U.S. Attorney General and set him on the path to becoming the only man to become both President of the United States and Supreme Court Justice, and to be largely remembered as pretty mediocre in both of those roles.
You and I used to have a law school professor by the name of Phil Clocious.
And we did. Let's raise a drink here to Phil Clocious, to David Harris, to Dan Steinbach, to all the fantastic people that were our professors at the University of Toledo College of Law.
They were all great professors. And Clocious specifically used to refer to the Lucky Sperm Club. This was something that Taft was definitely a member of, and it served him well, and he used it well.
And if we can get back to T.C. Campbell for a moment, he was not a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. He fought and clawed. He used brilliance and a bit of treachery and a big dose of moral pliability to become what he became before William Howard Taft led the fight to tear him down. We're not going to talk much about T.C. Campbell here, and it's not because he doesn't deserve it. It's because it has become a necessary editorial decision. Because the abbreviated version of what happened to T.C. Campbell is this. After the courthouse riot, Campbell held his ground and he refused to slink away. He stayed in Cincinnati practicing law. But when he was out of town on business, his huge mansion burned down after one of his sons pulled a gun on his babysitter. Then, because the house had burned down, it became more practical to move back to New York, where he established a lucrative and a sometimes very controversial law practice in New York, with some attempts to disbar him there. He also seems to have started a family on the side, Amy, having two sons by a woman who was not his wife. One of the sons took his name and one of them didn't. And then when the Democratic governor-elect of Kentucky was assassinated, and he was probably assassinated at the direction of the Republican Secretary of State and the defeated Republican candidate for governor, Campbell was hired as a special prosecutor. And he had this role, it was something you could do back then, because the assassinated governor's family, who were from Covington, And by the way, he was the only person to be assassinated as a sitting governor in American history to date. But his family didn't trust the Republican attorney general to prosecute the people accused of the murder. So Campbell made a bunch more bitter enemies in this job as special prosecutor. He also became national and international news again. And depending on who you believe, he was either a hero of justice in this case, or he was a puppet master of corruption, like so much of T.C. Campbell's life. Very polarizing. And either way, good guy or bad, it was all definitely very stressful, and it was bad on his health. So Campbell's doctor told him to take a vacation and specifically go breathe some salty ocean air. And in response to that, his son bought a yacht, one of his legitimate sons bought a yacht, and the family sailed south to the Bahamas, where their yacht ran aground, and Campbell ultimately died as a result of being raided by Caribbean pirates. And no, none of all of the incredibly ludicrous things I just said is made up. It's not a joke. All of that happened. He died as a result of literal pirates of the Caribbean. So it's not going to immediately follow this episode because it requires more research and it wasn't planned, but we decided that the fate of T.C. Campbell is so astoundingly crazy that it deserves at least one bonus episode.
When you walk through the metal detectors at the Hamilton County Courthouse today, you walk past Captain John J. Desmond's statue and a plaque honoring how he was slain by a vicious mob. But there has never been any plaque or recognition of the victims of the 1884 National Guard massacre. Until Mike tried to compile it, nobody had even bothered to list their names.
And what about William Kirk, the man who was murdered by William Burner and Joe Palmer, the man whose murder drove a city to madness? First, posthumously, it became clear that Kirk was a bigamist. When he married his wife, Minnie, who was probably a sex worker when he met her, he may have still been married to his ex-wife, Molly, the madam, although they may never really have been married. It's not really clear. But he was definitely still married to a woman named Sarah Kirk, who lived on a family farm in Kentucky. And it was at that farm where William first tried his hand at being a horse trader. Now she, meaning Sarah Kirk, never remarried. And she lived to be 90 years old. She's dying in 1930. My attempts to track Minnie Kirk ran into a dead end. After their infant son died, I believe that Minnie might have taken a job as a store clerk in a department store for a while. But after that, she disappears from public records entirely. Today, in Spring Grove Cemetery, just north of where William Kirk's body was dumped, there is a curving landscape line with ivy transitioning to grass. And this line goes between two large headstones. When you look at it, you'd probably assume that this is just the space between two graves. But it isn't. This very inauspicious little piece of land is the final resting place of William Kirk, the man that a city almost burned down over, but who nobody bothered to buy a gravestone for. This has been Truth Deferred, Season 1, The National Guard Massacre. Thanks. We'll see you in a couple of bonus episodes.